and welcome to Lunching with Lawyers. Lunching with Lawyers is brought to you by LorettaCrete.com. In this series of podcasts, Loretta explores the world of law graduates. She talks to lawyers, recent law graduates, and budding lawyers seeking alternatives or exploring how to get the jobs that they want. This podcast series is also for those thinking about pivoting or just wanting to do something different. So join Loretta for discussions with lawyers and law graduates about their careers and the paths they took to get to where they are. Let's explore what success in their profession looks like to them.
Welcome, friendlies, to my interview with Brian Hurd. Brian Hurd is the author of the recently published Avoiding the Aging Parent Trap. He's a passionate lawyer working at the coalface of elder law or law relating to older people and their families and the disputes and dysfunction brought on by aging parents. He is a partner in the law firm CRH Law. He writes and speaks regularly for leading senior associations and media outlets. For 3 years in a row, Brian has been one of Australia's best lawyers in senior and retirement law, as voted by his peers and recognised by Doors Guide. His foray into elder law began over 20 years ago when he was called in to mediate a dispute between a mother and her five daughters. Yes, five of them. This quickly led into the world of bowel care, and saw his practice morph into becoming a wayfinder for families navigating the experience of aging from a legal perspective. Since that early experience, as you guessed it, there's been quite a few humorous incidences along the way. And that's something that you definitely need in helping families navigate the process of aging from all perspectives. His many stories and experiences to share, which I hope you will do this evening on Lunching with Lawyers. Yes, it is the evening, not lunch. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Loretta. It's good to be with you.
Okay. And to help me interview Brian about his career and his new book is the ever delightful Noel Whittaker, and a friend of Brian's for more than 30 years, who also wrote the foreword to Brian's book. Welcome, Noel.
Great to be back.
Oh, good on you. Thank you. And so, Brian, why do you call yourself a wayfinder for families?
One of the reasons that I do what I do is because in the last 20 years, in terms of the practice I have, I've noticed that as a result of longevity in particular, the issue of the complexity of elderly parents has become more acute. And as a result, most of us, particularly with families that are blended, for example, or families that have four aging parents, such as the biological parents and the parents-in-law, little is done to address the effects of longevity on the broader family, such as what happens when those parents become age-dependent at different times in different ways. How does the family respond in terms of how to support those dependent parents? To what extent should they? What are the options and lifestyles available to them? So for me, finding a way for them through all that morass, that miasma of opportunities and lifestyle options, is what I do most. I had a case just last week where a woman came to see me for my wayfinding skills because she had actually read the book and discovered that by reading the book, what it teaches you is to not wait for the crisis to happen or that event. It's to anticipate and plan for that almost inevitable event. So she was coming in anticipation of her mother's event and talking about what her options were, because at the moment her mother was getting quite frail and fragile, and she could see that something had to happen soon or something would happen soon. So she was coming to see me to plan for that event, as opposed to waiting for it or watching it happen. She was coming in advance to look at what are the options and how do you go about managing all those bureaucracies that are involved, for example, in terms of aged care in particular. What do they all do? What are the rules, etc.? So she was becoming educated and well-informed.
So your book's already been a success, really?
I can see something there too.
Yeah, of course.
That there's a passage in Brian's book that just got to me, where the woman's having a busy day and the phone rings and the message is, Mum's had a fall and she won't be coming home. And her whole life changed in that phone call. Now, if you're not prepared for that, where will she go? Who will take care of her? If you're not prepared, if she needs aged care, you don't just ring up like a hotel and go.
There's don't you?
Like
I thought
no,
you could.
No. So if you aren't prepared, it's like all of a sudden having your house burned down if you aren't prepared. Being prepared is, well, I think, more than half the battle, Brian.
It is. And also having the courage to prepare, because preparing means not just you finding out, it also means involving your siblings, for example. It's very important to have them as allies rather than opponents. So involving them at the outset of the preparation process, and of course involving your mum and dad.
Because they will be difficult.
Resistant. They will be resistant. And commonly they say to a child, I'll let you know when I need your help.
Yes.
Which they never do, of course.
No.
So they wait and watch themselves become more fragile before they actually say, oh, it's time.
But to make it worse, I've got two friends, both have parents with dementias, with dementia, each of one parent. They both say these parents are accusing friends of theft. They've been told that's a common symptom of dementia, is accusing people of theft.
Mm.
But to make it worse, there are some people who thieve from their elders. And I think, Brian, that must be incredibly difficult, trying to navigate that minefield.
Extremely difficult. But this is the complexity that people don't understand. It's every family is different. Every scenario is different. And you can even see the complexities that are developing in the law in response to this. Because the law itself is changing, it's evolving in response to the issues that ageing parents represent to us, particularly around the issue of capacity. Yeah. We have a whole new guardianship regime, we have statutory wills, we have the reinvigoration of equitable principles, constructive trusts and undue influence, all those things are getting a new life.
Well, I was going to ask you, because going completely off where I was going to go, but in relation to wills and dementia, you do talk about when a person has not made a will, has dementia, but has an enduring power of attorney. Is there something then that can be done in relation to the fact that the parent doesn't have a will but has lost capacity?
Yes. Anyone can apply to the Supreme Court for the court to make a will, change a will for a person where they've lost capacity.
Mm.
So an enduring power of attorney could apply to the Supreme Court for that sort of will to be made by the court.
If there wasn't a power of attorney.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a power of attorney.
Oh, really?
Anyone can apply to the court for the court to make a will.
And this would be costly.
Potentially costly, particularly if...
Supreme Court.
Because when you go to the court, you have to say to the court, this is the will we think she would have made. And then you get the other children who say, oh, I don't think so. That's not the will she would have made. So you get this disagreement between the children, who are generally the parties to the application, about what sort of will mum would have made.
But why wouldn't you
that's expensive.
Yeah, but why wouldn't you just wait then until they die?
Yes. But
and then just do it under intestacy.
There's a famous case where she was a widower and they were from two separate families to start. And the court held that there was no way she would have left in her will that certain apartment to this daughter-in-law because she hated her. That sort of thing, isn't it?
That's right. So it's an argument that can be very, very argumentative amongst the family.
Mm.
But in terms of your question about intestacy, sure, you could leave it to intestacy if you wanted to. The difficulty these days, of course, intestacy doesn't deal with the more complex financial affairs that people have. Intestacy is fine if you've got a functional family and you've got a house and a passport bank account. But where you've got family trust, superannuation, etc., intestacy is a very poor solution to those more complex financial issues. And in the end, the financial cost of resolving that on an intestacy can be more than applying for a statutory will before the person died.
Okay.
And also,
I learned something already.
Most parents I know now have at least one kid living overseas.
Mm.
If you've got an overseas resident, that's another whole new ballgame, isn't it?
That's right. And, of course, on an intestacy, you can get people challenging the legal consequence of intestacy. In other words, for better provision. Whereas if you've got a statutory will made where all the children have been involved, it's hard to conceive that any of them would contest that will made by a court after the mum or dad dies.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go back then now to my question I know you completed your law degree in the 1970s. That's giving away your age a bit. Perhaps your book,
You're talking
Avoiding the Aging Parent Trap, is a book you may want to give to your children soon.
That's right. In fact, can I tell you, I have.
Oh, really?
I have, because it's something that they may not sort of jump at the opportunity to read it at the moment. But a lot of what's in the book is universal. It's not limited by time. A lot of it is relationships, how to deal with relationships in families as much as the law itself. So to that extent, it will be a universal publication that will need updating, but it doesn't need constant updating simply because a lot of what's there is just human nature, the analysis of human nature that I've seen come through my door, the functional, the dysfunctional, the absolutely extraordinary families.
It's been the subject of novels and textbooks for thousands of years, I think, hasn't it?
That's right. Exactly.
But now in this context between family and elderly people, it's a lot different, and there's a growing cohort of people who are needing care because we're not dying younger.
That's right.
But also there's new families being formed. I mean, widow marries widower, and they want to keep their assets separate, and there's every permutation and commutation, isn't there, and cultural issues, what some different cultures expect. And
well, as you know, I was responding to an email I got yesterday about a person who had read the book and asked me some questions about what's a compacto.
Yes.
What is a compacto, indeed?
Good question. I've never heard of a compacto. What's a compacto?
I thought,
it sounds like a filing cabinet. That's a compacto.
This is a classic example of, I have invented this term, but it's a reflection of the nature of older people's relationships, where they're going. For example, if you have a widow and a widower who meet, they've lost their respective spouses, but they don't want to marry, they don't want to be a de facto couple because they understand, presumably, the consequences of marrying or becoming a de facto. It creates all sorts of legal claims, potentially, against their estate. So what they try and do is something less than de facto. So they call themselves companions. And the trouble with companions is they don't realise that eventually they start sliding into a de facto relationship because they're invariably their relationship intensifies. And even though you don't have to live with someone to be a de facto or even indeed share a bed.
Is that right?
There are all these other factors that can contribute to the creation of a de facto relationship. So they think they're not a de facto because they're just companions and they don't sleep together or live in the same house together. And that's what I call compactos.
So I thought that was a lovely term actually.
So it's a combination of companion and de facto. So join together to become compactos.
Plus they get a bigger pension if they're two single people.
Correct.
The combined
financial guru you're talking.
Yes.
Exactly right.
So we have some people do it on purpose and pretend to be two singles.
We have people in retirement villages called tiptoers.
I love that. Yes, about going over to someone's place at 6 at in the dead of night at 6 p.m.
And then tiptoeing out at 4 a.m. the next morning, trying to hide what everyone knows anyway.
Especially in a retirement village. I'm going to talk a little bit about your career, Brian, before we get into your book a little bit more. I read somewhere that you started practicing law 35 years ago. Does that mean you had a career before you started practicing law?
I had a brief career. When I finished law in 1975, I went to Canberra and I was effectively a bureaucrat for about 6 years. And while I was there, I did mostly legal type bureaucratic jobs, but then got very bored with Canberra because Canberra is a place where you can predict your future. You'll be somewhere in the bureaucracy in Canberra for the rest of your life. Yes. Now, that could be interesting,
depending on what the sort of job is. Mm. But for me, it just wasn't very interesting in terms of where I was going to be going. So I came back to Brisbane, finished getting admitted as a lawyer, and then did my, as they call it in those days, my articles of clerkship.
Where did you do your articles then?
Who with?
Hill and Taylor, they were called.
Are they still around?
No, not at that name. I'm not sure they are now. They've changed their name. They've mutated to something else.
Everybody's changed their name now.
They do. Yeah, they even have letters now instead of names.
Like CRH.
CRH. CRH.
BDO? Because you didn't start.
BDO.
BDO.
Because you didn't AMZ. Start as. You didn't start as CRH lawyers, did you? What did you start as when you started
to practice? Back in the 70s, I started the firm with Goss and Downey.
Mm.
So Goss was Dwayne Goss. So he and Bob Downey formed the first firm. And it was mostly a criminal law legal aid firm. And then when Wayne was elected to Parliament in 1983, they employed me. So I came into the practice, leaving Hill and Taylor at that point, and did a lot of criminal law, a lot of personal injuries. It was a small legal aid practice, basically.
Great experience.
Great experience.
Fantastic experience.
Yeah, we were full of mission in those days because we were young.
Had the energy.
Had the energy. We had aspirations. The mission,
not the money.
And then as soon as you had children.
As soon as children came along, you realised that you needed money as well as mission. And so then, since I've been at that firm in one guise or another since then. Its name has changed over the course of time, and so has the work we do. Used to be All Things for All Men, so like Caesar's Wife, but these days it's specialised.
So it morphed into CRH Law. So did you become a partner then in 1988, or was it?
In 1988, I did, yes.
And so, but what made you then, what was it about stools that made you interested in elder law?
It's a terrible question.
Well, look, you know how life is full of happenstance. Now, in 2000, I had no interest in the area of law and elderly people. Elderly people were, for most lawyers, and to some extent still are, they're lost leaders. So you get them in to do their will cheaply with the anticipation that you'll reap the benefits when they die and get their administration. So older people weren't seen as magnets for good legal work. They were just seen in that particular pigeonhole. Then I got this phone call in 2000 from the director of nursing at an aged care facility in Brisbane. I don't know why she rang me, but she did. And as you
She'd seen you at some presentations.
I hadn't started presenting at that stage. I hadn't. It was just totally out of the blue. It was almost as though she picked up a pin and just put it in the telephone book. And when I went to see her, she explained what you already alluded to, that we had these five daughters all arguing about whether the facility was starving their mother to death. So the Don was really paranoid about this because that's a serious allegation, even in those days. So she had two pieces of proof that they weren't starving her to death. And the first piece of proof was this book she pushed across the table to me and said, this is the first piece of proof. This is our bail book. And in those days, everything was manual. So there was no electronic record keeping. So she opened the page of the resident. And sure enough, she said, now look at all her bowel movements daily. So her daily bowel movements are recorded every day.
That's what we've got to look forward to.
But it gets better. It gets better.
Sounds like a shitty job.
She then said, and we have another instrument that we use to determine a resident's health, and she called it a stool tool. It was this little laminated card, and on the card there were various coloured pictures of various types of stools. And each of them was an indication of the health of a person, depending on the type of stool and its colour, etc. So those two things I'd never heard of before.
No, I hadn't heard
and
of
them before. And
you probably haven't
heard
them either. Until I read the book.
Not a good dinner party topic, is it really?
But what I realised from that experience was this opened up a whole new world to me because it was a serious legal problem. Because these daughters were arguing amongst themselves and the facility was trying to rebuff them as much as possible but didn't know how to do it. So I became very involved and it was successfully resolved. That feeling of success is what lawyers look for, that outcome that makes people happy or happier. happiness is always an elusive thing in law, but certainly happier that it was resolved. And then I discovered an organisation in America called the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys of America. And they've been going since 1983 and had over 7,000 lawyers who just did elder law. That's all they did.
Wow. And so they certainly found a market for it in America. Did.
But 83 is fairly recent. It just shows how recent this is.
That's classic. That's true. Yes. Very true.
Yes.
Good observation. But I went to two of their conferences as well, one in Miami, one in Vancouver. And that's another indication. Up to that point, all their conferences had been held just in the United States. This particular year, they decided to expand the influence of elder law, and they went to Canada to have that annual conference, which was a big thing for America because everything revolves around America. And suddenly, off to Canada they went to spread the word. And there's quite a very active elder law fraternity in Canada now as well. So, yes, that was stimulating, and also to listen to people present about it and all the issues they were confronting in America just gave me all this light bulb moment.
So when you...
Can I tell you a funny story about that?
Yeah, of course.
In one conference, they have a segment where a lawyer can get up for 2 minutes and say one thing they've done in the last 12 months to improve their marketing. This lawyer got up and said, last year we got a cat. So now we have a cat in our office so that when the older residents come in and sit in the chairs, the cat sidles up to them and purrs and sits on their lap, etc. And then he said, sometimes the cat goes missing, as they do. So we call the cat Say. So when they try and find the cat, they go around the office going, here's Say, here's Say, here's Say. But a lot of it was really crass, but you could see they were thinking about the idea of how do you market to older people?
Yes.
For I'm told, for example, if you do an advertisement attracting older people, never show an older person outside in the full sun. Always show them with a hat on. Because as soon as an older person sees an older person outside in the sun without any protection, they turn away. They don't want to look at it. So never have an older person exposed to the sun without any protection. Those sorts of tricks are the trade.
That's interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting. And this is the consequence.
Fascinating.
Yes.
Oh, they wouldn't see that, would they?
No. So Brian was just showing the consequences of sun damage on his face because, like a lot of Queenslanders, has had to have, what is it, a...
It was a BCC, they call it, a basal cell carcinoma, cut out.
Yeah, cut out. And it's not the prettiest of sights. No. So it's
I have a face for radio.
I wanted to go back about this mother and the five daughters because did you resolve that mainly through mediation?
It wasn't resolved through mediation. Mm. It was resolved ultimately through negotiation.
Mm.
It was just about to go to mediation because the negotiation had proved intractable to some extent. And that's because mostly there was a dispute between the daughters. So it wasn't the five daughters against the home. It was a dispute between them where some of them were in support of the home and the others were not. So it was negotiated to some extent. But then we're about to go to mediation when the daughters who were the difficult ones engaged a lawyer. So suddenly we had two lawyers involved and bingo.
And sometimes
it was resolved.
And sometimes that's why it's really great if you do have, sometimes people get really worried about having a lawyer involved because they think they'll make it worse. But often when people get their own legal advice, they find, oh, well, maybe I am being unreasonable or maybe this is possible to resolve. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about mediation because you really talk in the book about the importance of mediating disputes. So, and I was going to ask you about that issue between siblings. Does it work? And how difficult is it to get people to come together to mediate a dispute?
Part of a product I'm putting out at the moment is called family planning. Not as you or Noel, you may have known it some years ago, but it's latter-day family planning. So what it's trying to do is to get the family on board in anticipation of events to discuss the issues. I have an agenda, a family planning agenda that we use if we can get all the siblings together by Zoom, however, because they're all over the place usually.
Yeah.
with mum or dad as well. So we have this collective of family members with an agenda talking about the future and how we plan for mum and dad's future with mum and dad. My reasoning is that approach can alleviate a lot of the subsequent disputes that can arise, particularly because if in this preliminary process everyone is on the same page, it's very difficult for later on someone from the family to say, oh, no, I never thought that was appropriate. So to that extent, it is a barrier or a buffer against people who change their mind later on. But it's also a collective decision, a collective coming together.
And so this is really taking succession planning in a business sense to the personal.
Correct.
And what I like, but the thing is, what often happens is that I think parents don't realise the importance of doing that early on. And so what often happens is siblings start fighting, parents are intractable, and how do you get people to mediate in those circumstances?
It can be very difficult. Some of my experience has indicated that there are children out there who are totally ornery, who are not prepared to talk about it, either because they're not the talkative types. There are a lot of uncommunicative people out there who don't want to expose themselves or express themselves in terms of their repressed enmities and jealousies, etc., from their childhood. They are difficult to mediate because they won't agree to mediate. They'll say, what's the point? We'll talk about it when we have to. It's not necessary now. So I try and regale them with those sad stories about people who don't do it in advance. But they are intractable and you can't change them. So you can't mediate. And there's no point mediating unless you can get everyone involved. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, the renegades sit out there in the wings and then come and attack, even where there's some type of agreement reached between the remaining siblings. So it's fraught.
And actually, thinking about the conversation that we've just been having, it actually makes me think that it's more important that elderly parents are the ones that call that if they can before. Correct. Because it's far better than one sibling, because otherwise all that sibling rivalry comes to pass and it's much more difficult.
That's a good point. Mm. I think it's a great point, don't you, Brian?
I do.
Yes.
There's a real pressure growing out there, which has been exacerbated by COVID and also the Royal Commission into aged care, particularly the adverse publicity and reputation that aged care providers have got from the Royal Commission's report in particular. And the effect of both those factors is that families are now being forced to confront something that they wanted to avoid at all cost, even the parents wanted to, and that is the only realistic way to provide care to parents that they're willing to even consider, because no one wants to go into residential aged care. And because they can't get sufficient home care, it's like hen's teeth, the only way to resolve that in a familiar and a familial environment is for the parents to move in with the family, or the family to move in with the parents.
That's a whole new range of potential issues.
It's happening.
Yes.
It is, because it's the realistic only option. And it's a big issue where parents are separated by illness. You know, we've got mum and dad at home, suddenly one of them has a stroke or whatever, and has to go into ultimately residential aged care, leaving mum at home. So now you've got the two parents living in two different places. Suddenly the cost of living has doubled.
Yes.
Because they're in two different places. And the cost of living in that residential aged care is very expensive.
Mm.
And that often reminds me of people who go into retirement villages in particular, thinking that they've both got two pensions to pay for the weekly fee or into manufactured parks, and then all of a sudden one of them has to go into aged care and they still have to pay that weekly fee, which then is nearly impossible.
So they're paying two fees, two weekly fees.
Yeah.
One who stays in the manufactured home park is paying a fee, as is dad or mum who's gone to residential aged care. Whammo.
So if you were looking at those options for accommodation as you age, where would you prefer to end up?
Personally?
Mm.
Probably dying at my desk.
I'd agree with you.
Would you?
Well, it's much simpler.
It is simple, isn't it? And it's cheap.
Mm.
You'd have to make these expensive choices between these expensive options about paying, you know, a RAD of $500,000 to go into residential aged care or an ingoing contribution into retirement.
And that's a villages. Refundable accommodation deposit? That's
refundable, right. Yes.
And I'll talk a little bit about that. But
we need to talk about that
too. Yes, I am going to talk about that. But one of the things that was really interesting about reading the book was you talked about granny flat agreements. And I wanted to ask you, or for the listeners, what are they and why can they be beneficial? Because most of the times we hear about elderly being abused in those sorts of scenarios, but sometimes they can be quite beneficial.
Mm. And they can be a tax trap, seriously.
Mm. Yeah, you can talk about the tax. Granny flats are becoming more popular. They are relevant, the concept is, to age pensions, mostly. Mm. And they're popular because they potentially allow an older person to either give away significant assets or money or transfer their home to a member of the family in exchange for that family member providing care for the rest of their life. Now, Centrelink has these what are called deprivation rules, where if you give away more than $10,000 a year or $30,000 over 5 years, anything above that amount is regarded as still your asset, even though you've given it away. Mm. So giving away large sums of money to your children in exchange for a granny flat is an exception to the deprivation rules. So the consequence of that is you can give away significant assets without triggering that rule, thereby preserve your pension.
Which for a lot of the elderly is extraordinarily important.
Very important.
Mm.
And it was interesting, the Law Reform Commission, the Australian Law Reform Commission, had a whole chapter on family agreements. They're called generically, granny flats are a form of family agreement. They talked about the importance of families looking to go into these agreements to get legal and financial advice. Because so many of these arrangements, and we see the downside of the breakdown of these relationships, and the biggest reason is because they're not documented. So the families haven't gone through the what if. What if I move in tomorrow? What if I don't like your husband anymore? Or you get divorced, or your husband goes bankrupt? Mm. I don't like you anymore.
Mm.
It's not documented. It's just a sort of mutual understanding that then goes kaboom when something happens untoward. I mean, I think in the book there's a good example of the tragedy of that, of the oral arrangement.
Yes.
In terms of the consequences for an elderly woman.
I thought there was a few about the importance of documenting any agreements. And what I found was interesting because I'd always thought, well, it's very important to document agreements in relation to loans, financial accommodations, but I'd never thought about it in terms of all the other things that you might put into one of those agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that really those agreements are all about when things go south, right, what's going to happen. But and I also like when you said it might convince you not to go into the agreement in the first place.
Well, we found that with people. We have this agenda.
I was going to ask
items,
you, yep.
And we go through that agenda, and sometimes you notice the more you go through it, the more their faces become glummer and glummer and glummer because they can see the stentorian implications of what they're committing to, potentially, and where it can go wrong and how badly it can go wrong.
Well, there are so many things. I mean, as you say, there could be the parent may be too ill to be there.
Mm.
The family could split. Or they just may want a holiday.
Yeah.
Yes, and what happens in those circumstances?
But you've also got tax issues. Now, the classic case is that mum gave the guy $400,000 in exchange for a granny flat, and that was a document. The capital gains tax was $200,000 because he had created a granny flat right and sold it to her.
Mm.
So the tax consequences can be horrendous.
Uh-huh. But there is some good news. And that is there's currently some draft legislation from the Commonwealth Government addressing that disastrous tax consequence, which is a tax consequence for the children, not for mum and dad.
Yes.
So it's a great idea for mum and dad, but it has really adverse tax implications for the children who are providing the care.
But it reduces their estate, of course. It reduces the estate.
Yeah. Well, that's the other implication with granny flats is the issue of how do you change your will? In other words, if you've got five children and you have this arrangement with one of them and you pay that one a large sum of money, how does it impact upon mum or dad's will?
Mm.
And the reality is it does.
Mm.
And it's particularly bad, of course, because it's a bit like a horse race. If you enter a grandfather agreement with your mum one day and she gives you $500,000 and then she dies the next day, you'd call yourself a winner.
Yes.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
However, if she lives another 27 years, you might call yourself a loser, potentially. So they're the sort of risks that people start to go, oh, they open their mouth and they start to realise the implications, but also the other siblings start to realise, hang on, how come you get all this benefit that we don't? Mum, you need to change your will. So there's all this pressure on mum or dad to change their will to compensate. But it's difficult to compensate because you don't know how long that arrangement will last. $500,000 may be a chicken feed in terms of compensation for caring if, in fact, mum lives for another 30 years.
Mm.
But the big thing is here is that often comes from the sale of the family home.
Yes.
It may be the only asset that mum has anyway.
Yes.
All of a sudden, four-fifths of the kids have missed out on them.
Yeah.
You know, most kids think, well, I'm going to get a share of the family home. It's, yeah, these are serious issues. They're big issues.
Serious, and you can start to see the increasing complexity of it.
Mm.
It's these layers of, it's like a wedding cake. You know, have you seen a traditional wedding cake? You know, you've got layers of fruitcake with passed in marzipan. And the layers are supported by these fragile Roman columns.
Yeah.
And at the top is the smallest layer. And usually you see the smiling newly married couple.
That's right.
In this case, what you've got are the forlorn elderly parents
sitting
on top of the wedding cake and looking down at their children on the other layers, wondering what's going to happen to us.
It's a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah.
And I think, though, too, that parents want to be fair, mostly with their children, and want to ensure that all of them get a share.
That's a very generalisation.
Yeah. Yes,
that's probably true to a certain extent.
Mm.
The difficulty for parents, not so much the current older generation, because their finances are relatively simple. Our generation, the next older generation, their financial affairs are complex. And when your financial affairs are complex, that makes being fair difficult.
Yeah, that's true.
How do you get fairness out of a family trust, a superannuation fund, various companies, for example, shareholders? It's just so complex. You tend to throw it up into the air and see where it comes down, but it's very complex to be fair.
Okay, so that in relation to these agreements, do you always think you should get a lawyer?
Yes, but you should get a lawyer who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah, and what about if you only have like a very small estate or you just, you know, like you might have not much at all? Do you always need to? I think it's really important to document, but do you always need a lawyer to write those agreements for you?
You do.
Mm.
Even though your affairs might be simple,
mm.
because what the agreement really targets where your affairs are financially simple is not so much the financial arrangements. It's the consequences of breakdown.
Mm.
So the importance of the agreement is to address what happens if the relationship breaks down and mum or dad have to move out. How are they going to do that? When are they going to do that? How are they going to pay to go somewhere else? Where's the money coming from? So that part of the agreement tends to be the most important part where the financial arrangements are relatively straightforward.
Mm.
It's that end game, that what if part of the agreement that's so important. And that's why lawyers who know what they're doing know what those what-ifs are, as opposed to lawyers who don't know what they're doing and have never come across any what-ifs.
And how do you find those sorts of lawyers? Like, how do you find people who are expert? I mean, they can always come to you, Brian, but what about if they don't have access to Brian?
Well, now, there's an organisation, I think, called STEP, isn't it?
Step,
and that's a fairly new issue, I think it was.
Well, it stands for the Society of Trust and Estate Planning Practitioners.
That's it. It
emanates from England, where they established the first. So Australia is like a branch.
Right.
But they are very much trust and estate planning practitioners. We haven't got an E in there for elder law.
Gotcha.
So much of this expertise that I've got is not captured by the traditional succession lawyers who do trusts and estate planning and estate disputes. Elder law is very much a succession issue, but it's while they are alive.
Mm. Yes.
As opposed, it's a live succession issue.
Mm.
Because as you may know, the issue of losing capacity and decision-making for people becomes an estate planning process. So your estate consists of not only what you have when you die, it's what you have when you're alive. Yeah. And what you do with it when you're alive. Or what somebody else does with it on your behalf if you've lost capacity. So that's a really, really live estate planning issue, even though you haven't died. But you have died to some extent by having lost your capacity.
Yes.
That's a form of death. I don't like to be too dramatic about that. But in terms of the death of decision-making for you, that's what incapacity is.
Yeah, for sure.
Well put.
I was talking to Noel about this just before we came upstairs, and it's interesting that as people age, sometimes the law, society, and adult children start treating you more and more like a child. You need to be protected. And I love the story in the book about the man that lived in the park and his children thought this unsafe. What happened?
He's still living in the park, as I know. Very happy. He calls it the Hotel de Park. And he's rich. That's what you can do.
Lovely.
Newfound park. Yeah, lovely.
So what?
It was a chosen lifestyle.
What annoys me about anything is the symbol now for old people is a walking stick. You see in the ads for COVID, if you're over 70, suddenly they put next to that thing a walking stick, and I think that's frightful.
Or they're walking into the sunset, or shuffling into the sunset.
Shuffling.
Or they use the word still.
So that's not the... That is not something that really the law looks at, whether if you still have capacity, whether you're safe or not. Is that true? Or is there some situations where the law might say your behaviour, even though you may think that you have capacity, your behaviour is so out of the ordinary, and even though you know what you're doing, they still may take away your ability to make decisions. And I was thinking about the story about the woman, I think it was a woman that kept paying the scammers for the relationship, was it?
Yeah.
So what was...
We call that love under the influence.
I haven't heard that before.
You've got some great stuff.
Compactor, love under the influence.
That's a difficult thing because for her, of course, she was a widow. She lived in a home by herself. She had limited friends. Her social outings were limited. So her society became her computer.
Mm.
That's where she lived. That's where she had connection, engagement with a computer.
Mm. Yeah.
So the natural society for her was to create it on the computer.
Mm.
So the question could be asked, what's wrong with her giving thousands of dollars to some Irishman living in Indonesia, if that makes her feel better, if that makes her feel she's in love, that makes her happy. There's an American organization, only in America, called Squalor Rights, where they assert they have the right to live in squalor. Now, it's hard to argue against that, of course, unless they're impacting on other people. She has the right to lose her money if that makes her happy.
But why... Well, does she or why
didn't
she?
In this case, her daughters were so concerned, both for pragmatic reasons and because they didn't want mum spending all her money because one day she may have to go into residential aged care, so she needed to save for her future and not spend her future. We went off to QCAT and based on her conduct, based on the way she led her life, QCAT decided that she didn't have the capacity to make her own financial decisions based upon the fact that she was a victim of undue influence.
Mm.
So to that extent, the daughters were very happy about that. She was very unhappy about it because suddenly she couldn't just keep paying herself. She had to get permission from her daughters to do it because they became the new administrators. That made her unhappy. Now you can ask yourself, is that right? Is that fear? Is that leaving her in the lap of her daughters?
But surely it begs the question, why was she so lonely with two daughters? One would think the daughters would have filled some of the void a long time ago that she could only find on the computer.
There's no law about that.
No.
Both the girls were working, so they had that excuse.
Yes.
And one of the girls didn't like her mum very much either. That was another excuse.
I think so. I think there's a bit more on this one. I know.
So one of the things that you did talk about is the refundable accommodation deposit that you have to pay when you go, or that you may be assessed as having to pay if you go into residential aged care. And so you did warn against the, those children who are trying to do the right thing and say, well, you're about to go into aged care. We need to sell the home to pay for this, what's called a RAD. Why is that not a good idea?
Why is it not a good idea?
Mm.
Because there's a potential tax and or Centrelink implication to start with. In other words, if you sell the family home, when it's the family home, generally speaking, well, at least after 2 years, it becomes, in terms of the proceeds of sale, an assessable asset. So you've got a non-assessable asset in the home. If you then sell it, you turn it into cash. That cash is an assessable asset. So suddenly you've got all this large sum of money, most of which probably won't be needed to pay the RAD. But some is used to pay the RAD, leaving this money left over, which is an assessable asset.
But the RAD's exempt, isn't it?
Yeah.
So how would you avoid it if that's the only thing that the parents have is the family home?
Well, you can keep it for 2 years without selling it. And it's not assessed. Once that 2 years ticks over and you haven't sold it, it starts becoming an assessable asset. So you're going to have $1 million home that's non-assessable, and 2 years later, $1 million home assessable. That impacts on your aged care fees as well. Up go your aged care fees, what's called the means tested care fee. So you've got 2 years to decide what to do. If you've had someone living with you as a carer, such as a member of the family, and they've been doing so for 5 years before you move into residential aged care, and that person, member of the family, continues to live in that house will be exempt while that person lives in the house.
You can see why it's complex, can't you?
You can see why it's complex.
Extremely complex.
Yeah, of course.
It's even worse.
But the RAD's exempt as well, of course. So by going to it, isn't it? It's exempt, yes. So by buying the RAD, you've gone exempt, assessable, back to exempt for the amount of the RAD.
Correct.
Yes.
It gets more complex.
All right. Tell me, why is it more? There's more.
Much more.
A major legal issue that most people don't understand about RADs, and that is, and I was giving you the thumbs up on this one. I had a client yesterday, just before my operation. She got a letter from a solicitor saying, your stepmum needs to go into residential aged care. And we want your father, the second husband, to pay her refundable accommodation deposit because the stepmother has no money, but dad, my client's dad, has lots of money. So she came to see me about that because she thought, something not right about this, something's not right. And she was right, because the law is, if dad paid that money, say $400,000 RAD, on behalf of his second spouse, the daughter's stepmother, to the aged care facility, the law says when that stepmother dies or leaves that aged care facility, that RAD must be refunded to the resident or their estate, not to the person who actually paid it. So what that means is dad effectively would be giving $400,000 to his stepchildren, because mum has made a will saying, giving everything to my own children.
Yes.
So the $400,000 flows from dad to mum and then from mum to her children. And I was talking to one of the biological children who, when she heard that, went, wow. Now, question the marital vow. What does the marital vow mean? Because they both took the vow a second time, in which they said, till death
do us part.
Which is now, till death or dementia do us part. So she had to go into residential aged care. He couldn't look after her anymore. So the issue is, what would he do, having made that vow? Would he, as a husband, a good, upstanding, moral husband, say, I have the obligation and the duty to pay that rat?
Mm.
As opposed to, no, I don't. I'd rather that money went to my own children.
Mm.
Now, the older generation are very moralistic. And the woman got back to me later and said, her father has decided to pay it because he believes that's the obligation of the matrimonial vows, irrespective of the financial consequences.
Question for you. Would he be able to lend that to the kids?
Yes. So the solution for us at this stage, having decided to actually make the money advanced, is to create a loan agreement between him and her.
Yes.
Such that that money comes back to him from her estate when she dies. Now, that still has potential problems because you're dependent on that money coming back and being in the estate and sufficient to pay back the rent.
Mm.
You don't know what the rest of her estate's like.
Oh.
Mm.
And we're also suggesting security. In other words, that some security for the repayment of the loan should also be provided.
Mm.
It's interesting, though. And like you said, though, at the end of the day, even if he made that decision to give that money because he felt a moral duty to do it, the thing, though, the difference between that and just paying over the rat is that there are no surprises.
Correct.
Because the daughter then will know if the mother dies, or, you know, her father will know that if the stepmom dies, that the money will go to her children. And so the animosity has already been dealt with beforehand because they've had advice.
Correct.
And I think that's just so valuable because no one would have been happy if that had have come as a surprise after the stepmom had died.
Well, I've been involved in litigation where the father refused to pay. So the stepchildren, who were the enduring attorneys for mum, issued Supreme Court proceedings.
On what?
On what basis?
Issued Supreme Court proceedings. Well, he actually died, the father, before the mother. So the mother went into aged care. And you would have expected her to have died first, but she didn't.
Mm.
He died. So then the claim was against his estate in terms of the money itself not having to be repaid, that they wanted better provision from his estate. That's all. Because they're entitled as stepchildren.
Yeah.
It's a minefield.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's a minefield. Right. Don't get into compactos, don't get into de factos. We still have time. One of the things you mention in the books is that couples should enter aged care on a different day. That seems bizarre. What was there a reason for this?
Well, it's complex, we told you that.
It's really complex.
Because it reflects the way they assess your assets at what point in time.
Mm. Uh-huh.
So they assess your assets. If you both go in together, they assess your combined assets. If you one of you goes in one day, they assess half your assets.
Mm.
So half of your assets are less than all your assets.
Yeah, of course.
So the reality is it's cheaper to go in one day and another person to go in the next day. Because they're going in on separate days with only half the assets in them.
And, well, that is just the weirdest thing, but it's so Aussie, isn't it?
It's
the law, isn't it?
It's the law. I don't have any time to tell clients. It's the law.
One of the major findings of the Retirement Income Review was that people were confused by the complexity and the way that different things interact with Centrelink and tax, estate planning, aged care.
Yeah.
Extremely
complex.
It's not but surprising.
Your book at least helps understand the minefield, right?
Yeah, it brushes the surface because every family is different. That's the problem. You can never answer everyone's.
But most people don't know what they don't know. So at least in your book, you're giving people a hint of what they may not know. I think it's so important.
Yeah. Well, I thought we might leave the book for just a few minutes as we come to the end of this interview. And I wanted to know what's your number one tip for maintaining and strengthening your professional relationships. You've talked about the importance of relationships amongst families. What's your tip?
As a profession?
As both in your profession and personal life.
In my profession, it's constantly communicating with your clients.
Mm.
And that means not because they've got a problem to fix, but because I have, for example, a newsletter. And all that sounds very cliche, but it works.
Yeah.
Because your face is before them all the time, and you're also creating issues that are interesting.
Well,
so a lot of people say my newsletters are very interesting.
Mm.
They talk about things that no one else talks about.
It's a very good one.
Yeah.
Mm. I get a lot of newsletters, but I think yours is probably the best I get.
Yeah.
It's very good. It looks good. It's got good content.
Yeah. And it's targeted to the work I do as opposed to just general law. So communicating with clients is important.
Can anyone get a copy? Can anyone subscribe to your newsletter?
Yes.
Oh, good.
You can do that on the web. Or...
Well, I'll put that in the show notes.
So oh, that, the show notes.
Yeah. So my takeaways from this book were get legal advice,
yeah.
document arrangements with family,
yeah.
get a will, an enduring power of attorney and an advanced health directive. Don't sell the family home to pay a refundable accommodation deposit for home care it could affect your pension rates without advice. And if you pay a refundable accommodation deposit for someone else, it will be paid to the person's estate, not you. Is there anything I missed?
Granny flood agreements are a minefield. Be very careful.
Okay, well, thanks, Noel. So in the words of Brian Hurd, do something now. My advice is buying the avoiding the aging parent trap is a good start.
Confront the future.
Yeah.
Both for yourself and for your parents.
So thank you, Brian and Noel, for sparing the time to talk to me. If you want to find out more about Brian, there are show notes with each of my episodes, including contact details for each of my guests on my website, www.lorettacrete.com. Please drop me a line if you have any questions or know of someone who may be interested in being interviewed for this podcast. Until next time, thank you so much again, Brian and Noel. And until next time, goodbye, friendlies.
Thank you, Lorena.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Lunching with Lawyers. If you enjoyed this episode or have questions or comments for our guests, head to the show notes for this episode and click on the contact links below. If you have suggestions, ideas or questions, or would even like to be part of this series, head to the Contact Us page on our website, www.lorettacrete.com.